Accession number 22572, Reel 3.
Reverend L.E.M. Claxton, Reel 3. Could you say something about how you arranged accommodation for church services when you were in Yorkshire?
Yes, if I could find the parish church or if there was a church available, or it had to be a village hall sometimes, but see, the companies were spread about and stretched all around the coast.
Yeah.
And we had to have services where we could, really.
Did you find the clergy generally obliging? Were they happy to
I found the clergy very, very obliging. Mm. I don't. I had no trouble at all, as I can remember, with any parsons. Mm. No, they were all very good, I think.
When you were going out on your voyage, what were you doing day to day on ship to keep yourselves occupied?
How do we keep ourselves occupied? Well, we had exercises with paper. We played bridge a lot, played Van Tieren. We drank, we enjoyed our food, we had lectures. Well, you couldn't do very much in the way of training because there wasn't able to do it, but you do it theoretically. And then we had the concert parties, of course, and the dance band. We didn't have the dance band at that point. That was later on. They were there, but they went to India with us. All their instruments were packed away. There was a band. There was a band. That's right. I'm getting mixed up. Yes, there was a band. They did play the dance band. You made the best of it, really. I mean, nothing specific you could say we did. It was very boring, really. But after we left Cape Town, we were sailing. We didn't know where we were going. We didn't go to Madagascar. We could have been in Madagascar. Well, we had this wonderful send-off. We thought we were, God's own division, really. We were sailing up towards the Red Sea. I was standing at the back of the ship, and I suddenly noticed that we'd done a right-hand turn. I thought this must be temporary. It wasn't. It was a right-hand turn. And we were on our own then, because our particular ship was fast enough to beat any Japanese submarine. And I thought, God, that must be India we're going to. And indeed it was. And we had an officer's training group on the deck when the commanding officer, who of course served in India, told us what a wonderful place it was to serve in. And finished off by banging the table and said, "Gentlemen, you will like India." Well, when we arrived in Bombay, morale had dropped. Talked about morale early on. Dropped like a stone. We were so depressed.
Why was that?
Well, India. Nothing to do in India. The Japanese had conquered Burma, but there was no fighting in India. We'd no idea what we wanted to do. And I knew we didn't. We were a mechanized division. We weren't sort of trained for jungle warfare.
You've been training for mobile operations, hadn't you, in Yorkshire?
Yes. Like the Middle East, you see. Yes. That's what you're expecting. And there was nothing to do. So, more of that later on. But when we arrived in Bombay, we found great notice on the quayside, "Quit India." Mm. They're very helpful. Then we had to do a march. It's boiling hot, just before the monsoon broke. Very, very hot. And we were issued with some short officers had, by Harrods, I think they'd been made. We called them bucket shorts. They were things you could pin up and pin down over your knees, tuck them into your stocking, your hose tops, keep away the mosquitoes. That was the idea. Wonderful idea, but they looked absolutely awful. And they were very long, they were just about the knees. And we marched through the street to Bombay to show the flag, looking like God knows what we looked like. The citizens of Bombay looked on astonished. We were very ashamed of the whole thing, really. People fell out because of the heat as well. It was awful. And we eventually got into a train and went to a place called near Kirki or Pune. A special camp, tented camp. And it was called Peshan Camp, called by the troops, of course, Passion Camp. Needless to say, and we lived there for about a month, I think. During that time, we did route marches and exercises. But the miracle was when the monsoon broke, those very brown hills which were around us suddenly became wonderfully green. It was miraculous to see the change. But unfortunately, they also the monsoon brought a lot of tents down, so we were very wet. And eventually, we moved from there to a place called Ahmednagar to show the flag again into this. It wasn't a tented camp; it was a sort of barracks. And we went around the countryside shooting off mortars and things to impress the local population. The GHQ Delhi had not the slightest idea what to do with us, really. We weren't any use in the Arakan. We weren't any use. I think one brigade went off the Arakan. Mm-hmm. Yes, six brigade went off.
Did you see any signs of agitation or anti-British feeling in the area around Ahmednagar?
Sorry?
Did you see any signs of agitation or anti-British feeling?
Not anti-British, no. We were very, very... The Indians were quite friendly. Well, the only sort of camp followers, a lot of them. Mm. They had their ear very close to the ground. The Charwallas knew what's going on before anybody else did, you know. It's quite extraordinary. The Bush Telegraph was fantastic. But no, we were very fed up with GHQ Delhi.
Yes.
Because they didn't know what to do with us. Mm. And eventually we went down from there to Secunderabad, where we had a lovely couple of months. And it was there we started playing games more seriously, still having exercise and, you know, training and so on. But I went to the bazaar. I had shared a bungalow with the doctor, Joe Chamberlain. And I thought, well, what a nice place it would be to have a piano to practice on, play on, you see. I wasn't one there, but I thought I might possibly. I went down to the bazaar to buy some sports equipment. And when I was there, sipping a cup of tea in the bazaar while they bought the sports equipment round, I happened to say to the chap, well, any chance of hiring a piano in Secunderabad? And again, I was tapped on the shoulder by at least two people. You want piano, Saab? You want piano, Saab? And the deal was done. And before I got back to my bungalow, the piano had been delivered. Wonderful. It's quite extraordinary.
It sounds like an excellent service.
Absolute service. Mm. Fantastic. Mm. And we had a wonderful chowkidar who sat at the door during the night, throughout the night, when the doctor and I were sleeping in our separate beds. Separate rooms, actually, we had. And in the morning, he'd say, 6 o'clock, and he would bang the door, the floor, with his stick and say, she is 6 o'clock. That is one other thing I remember there. Secunderabad was delightful. We had a club there, a European club. We played tennis and we had parties there, and it was great fun. A very nice padre there called Paddy Collier, who later married me. That comes later. Actually, but
when do you remember when you first heard you were going to be sent into Burma?
Yes, I do very well remember. Mm. You see, but then I think what happened was Mountbatten arrived in SEAC to take over control of Southeast Asia Command, and he had rather good ideas. He decided they would train us for combined operations for landing in the Arakan.
Had you been carrying on with mechanized training then?
We had mechanized transport, but we there was this battalion or whatever it is, a regiment of 3rd Carbineers, I think they were.
Yes.
I think they were 3rd Carbineers. And we were then trained for combined operations. A place called Kag Vasla up in the north, a lake. And this was really tremendous fun, actually. Mm. You know, when we went to Juhu Beach in Bombay, holiday beach along the seaside, and there we slept in tents and swam in the morning and went down the beach and swam at midnight sometimes and got to these landing craft and from in and out how to do it. And we trained a lot there. And then we went down to Belgaum, to Goa. Mm-hmm. Goa, that holiday resort, and Goa was occupied by the Japanese, of course, by imaginary Japanese. We did an exercise, huge exercise, with the Royal Indian Navy. We landed on the beaches of Goa and drove the Japanese off them, etc. and we stayed there. We were promised just for Christmas, 1941. We stayed there. We were promised Christmas in a barracks in Belgaum, which we were looking forward to very much. And we were training in the jungle. We were doing jungle warfare. And I had bought in Bombay, not being able to carry a piano around, I bought a, what you might call a squeeze box, a little organ, which you could carry around with you. You blow, play it with your feet, you know, blow it up and then play on it. And in the jungle, we managed to get this there, and we practiced singing carols. I was determined to have a carol service for Christmas. And we practiced singing carols in the jungle. You know, I was playing the piano, and had to, got a choir around, and we learnt these carols, and it wasn't, as I say, the ox and the ass and the camels which adore it, was the cobra and the baboon and the tigers were wondering what the hell was going on in their jungle. Anyway, the time came, we had our carol service in Belgaum, and then very nice Christmas, really, in barracks.
What do you remember about the jungle warfare training? What skills were you taught for jungle warfare?
Not a great deal, really. How to move around quietly and how to avoid being seen and how to hide and so on. Mainly, from my point of view, I mean, I don't remember much. Didn't learn much about it. I think you just play it as it comes, really. But it's all on foot, of course. There's no mechanized transport. Anyway, after Belgaum Christmas, we went to a place somewhere in India called Galanchi. The only thing I remember about it was that we were there only a few months, I think. We cleared a space to make a cricket pitch, cricket ground. And the prisoners were used to move the stones. And they thought I was making a place for a church parade. It wasn't true, to play cricket on. And we played, this is where we did all the education course. I became education officer then.
What were you doing there then? What sort of subjects were you discussing?
Well, we were just waiting to be told what to do, really, basically. Nobody decided. We waited to do the combined operation of the Arakan.
But when you were doing the ABCA work, the education work, what sort of subjects were you discussing?
Well, they had these little leaflets they gave us, their history and various things like that. Not Padre's Hours. I had Padre's Hours, too. Yeah. And a church parade, of course. And communion services. But it was just the usual kind of normal kind of training we did.
What would you do in Padre's Hour? What was the...
What did I do in Padre's Hours? I'd usually have a sort of lecture, like... came in handy later on when I was running a church house. Why do I believe in God? Why? What are the reasons for believing in God? Then I talk about the Bible. What is the Bible? How did it come into being? What it teaches us? And then what about the church? How did that come into being? This sort of thing, you know. And I've talked for, say, 10 minutes, and then I have questions. It was very interesting, really.
Did you get a good attendance?
They were compulsory.
They're compulsory?
Yeah, compulsory, yes.
Did you go around then company by company? Or?
Yes, yes. They used to come to a central place for... Mm. Oh, yes, yes. It was very interesting, really. So there was plenty to do in one way and another. Then suddenly we got the order to move to the other side of India. The Japanese had not only conquered Burma, but they were about to conquer India too. We didn't know much about it. We got in trains, and we took 7 days to get across. 7 days to get across to Calcutta. And then we got into a little... they had, in India, they've got broad gauge and narrow gauge trains. We got to a narrow gauge railway, which ran from Calcutta up to Assam. And halfway up there, there's a place called Dimapur, which is a sort of railhead. And there, from Dimapur, from this railway going from south to north, is a road which runs eastwards, right angles, up to the Naga Hills, from sea level to about 5,000 feet. There's a place called Kohima, and on that side are... On the right-hand side are hills, various sizes, and on the left is a valley. And this road winds its way, like 50 miles. This we got out at Dimapur, and we were there. Japanese, we discovered when we got there, had established a roadblock, 32 miles up the road. We knew that. But Kikohima itself is a very strategic point on the road. That road was the thing we had to defend at all costs. It was our lifeline, really. And it remained our lifeline because it was the only way of getting into Burma, really, along a road. It's a good road, actually. But the monsoon had played havoc with it, and when we got onto it eventually, great sheets of tarpaulin had been hung on the roadside to prevent the rain from washing it away. It was quite a bizarre sight.
How were you moving? Were you in motor transport for this
move
down
we're
the road?
Walking.
You were marching.
There was some transport. We only had a very small quota of. I did actually have a car. Mm. I had a car, but I walked with the troops. I didn't ride in the car. The car came up later. We arrived in Dimapur on Easter Saturday. You know, 1942, and I'd forgotten what day of the week it was, but Geoffrey White, the signaling commander, said, "Padre, tomorrow's Easter Day, do you realize it?" So we had a church service. We were digging in, you see. Japanese patrols might have been around, so we had to be very careful. We had my church was a map reference in the jungle. I had communion services there, set up my shop there. And when I took the service, I kept hearing noises in the jungle, crackling of twigs, men shouting to each other, "Bill, where are you? Where's the bloody church?" And this sort of thing. I had to celebrate three times that day because they couldn't find the church. Their map reading wasn't very good.
What was your equipment then? What did you take in order to set up shop?
What?
What did you have with you as equipment in order to set up
shop? I had a little field communion set. A thing in a little suitcase, about the size of a little like a handbag, you know, which contained all the necessary things. I had, I used to use ordinary bread, some wine, a bottle, and that's really all I had, actually. My equipment, which normally you carry ammunition in, was for using for bottles of wine and wafers and things like that. Now, I didn't have any clothes, apart from what I was standing up in, except a stole to put around my neck. Mm. That was all, really. But we had that service.
What did you use for an altar?
Now, it varied, really. If I could get a hold of a table of some kind, I would use that. But what did I use? I can't remember, quite honestly, what I used in the altar there. I can't remember. I must have had something. I can't remember what it was. I know, I've forgotten. Must have been something. I can't remember.
What when you were doing this march down the road from Dimapur, what sort of rate of progress were you making? How many miles would you cover in a day's march?
Rest every 10 minutes. I don't know. I never thought of it. We set off on the Monday, Easter Monday, to go up the road. Our first job, of course, was to smash the roadblock. The Worcesters had a go. It didn't fail. The Camerons did smash the roadblock. We were allowed to go through the Dorsets again. And then we marched up to a place called Zubzo, which was a kind of base, where, to my horror, I'd heard that my pal, the Roman Catholic padre, was killed by a shell. So we were really in the battle then.
Mm. What had the roadblock consisted of? What did you see as you went through
it? Well, blocks of, I don't know, both stones they'd built up, and a gun, of course, shooting down the road, so you couldn't get past it. Later on, we learned not to go attack roadblocks direct. We used to go round a what we call a left or right hook through the jungle, possibly at night, and appear on behind them somewhere. This was the way we had to do it. You couldn't attack the roadblock directly. But the Camerons did, I think. They had heavy casualties, but they got through it all right, and we edged our way up. All the time there were Japanese patrols, all the time we were patrolling, all the time we were digging in at various places, and eventually we got into... But what I forgot to say was Kohima had been occupied by the Sam Regiment for a bit. But the Royal West Kent Regiment was flown in from the Arakan, and they actually occupied... See, may I try and describe Kohima? You'll get there, 5,000 feet up. The road goes round, right-hand turn, on the way to Imphal. We discovered also that Imphal was a plain about 50 miles from Kohima. And it was the place where the 14th Army, four corps, all the cream of the 14th Army, under Bill Slim, was assembling, getting ready to conquer Burma. The Japanese had other ideas. We discovered this when we got there. They had two divisions that surrounded Imphal, so four corps completely cut off, unable to move one way or the other. Kohima was under attack from another division, which came across country, which everybody had said was impassable. The Japanese passed it using elephants as transport. And they, being Japanese, they made it. And they were about to attack Kohima. They surrounded it. Kohima, 5,000 feet, is does a right-hand turn towards Imphal. But along that road are a series of hills which had fancy names like Garrison Hill, Cookie Picket, the Pimple, Jail Hill, and so on. They're all individual hills, but they were all occupied by the Japanese, except for Garrison Hill. Now, the Royal West Kent had sat on Garrison Hill for 3 weeks. They were surrounded, of course, too, but they kept the Japanese off. They were attacked night after night. They couldn't evacuate their casualties. They were fed by parachute, supplied by parachute, on this quite small area, but the hill sloped down towards the road onto a kind of spur, and at the bottom of that hill, but about, I suppose, 20 feet up from the road, was a flat space on which the deputy commissioner had lived. He had a bungalow there, the DC's bungalow, and he also had a tennis court on that flat space. The Japanese surrounded the tennis court pretty well. They occupied the strategic point where the road turned round, where the road junction, the road led off to the Naga village on the left. And we had to fight our way into Kohima, not very much, but we got there eventually and relieved the West Kents. Oh, they built... on that hospital, on that Garrison Hill, a wonderful hospital, Hill it's called, and this hospital was slit trenches, of course, and they had a marvellous operating theatre, which was lined with parachutes and lit by lamps from, you know, 1500 weights and so on. It was a wonderful setup, and therefore they lived there for 3 weeks under these conditions. Well, we managed to get them relieved. They went back to... Never saw them again.
Did you see them as they were coming out?
No, we didn't. We were doing something else, I think, at the time. I never saw them coming out. This was... 6th Brigade did the advance onto Kohima. It was a three-pronged attack, really, or movement. 5th Brigade, the Dorsets were lent to 6th Brigade, so we were with 6th Brigade for the time being. Mm. They had 4 battalions instead of 3. And the rest of 5th Brigade went across down the valley to the Naga village to get rid of Japanese over there. And 4th Brigade went up the hills further up, higher hills, to approach from that angle, you see. The whole idea was to get the Japs off Kohima Ridge to start with, the Battle of Kohima. And it took us a month to do it. Mm. See, the trouble was, I don't know if you can visualize a Japanese bunker, but to get a Japanese out of a bunker, there's only one way, and that's to get a medium tank close up and fire point blank into it. That gets their head down. Mm. And while their heads are down, you give some brave chap a pole charge with its fuse reduced from 9 seconds to 3. If you kept it left to 9 seconds, they'd simply throw it out again. Who approaches the bunker, shoves it inside, so the thing explodes inside, and then they come out. That's the only way to get them out of the bunker. So it was vital for us to get a tank onto the tennis court. The trouble was, there was a kind of rough track, but the monsoon had broken, slippery as hell, bulldozers, tanks, all crashed and hired things. There was a gun across the hill, on Treasury Hill across the way, firing at us all the time. By the grace of God, we had the Royal Air Force in command of the skies. We only saw one Japanese lot of planes. The Royal Air Force dominated the thing during the daytime and kept the guns quiet because they couldn't bring their guns out, you see. They were hidden. So the RAF, so during the daytime, but the guns opened up at night. And it was very hellish, really. And my first impression of Kohima, apart from dead bodies lying around, was of looking what looked like a ladder climbing up the Garrison Hill. It wasn't a ladder, it was a lot of Japanese bodies who'd been trying to attack. And they'd been shot on the way. It was a most eerie place. And the Dorsets, the first night, they did an attack on around the bungalow on the tennis court, and they secured a position overlooking the road which was the strategic point which dominates that turn. It had to be vital to hold that point, keeping head command of the road, and they got a position there. Heavy. They went in 128 strong, A Company. And they were there for 2 or 3 days. But every night, a little gun on Treasury Hill fired over open sight, straight in their position. And they came out after 3 days with 28 men.
That's a terrific way to casualties.
A lot of wounded. You could get there during the daytime. You couldn't do it at night, though. During the daytime, you could get round and walk up to this place or climb up to it.
Did you manage to get up to it?
Yes, I went there, but in the daytime. Mm. And I buried any bodies which were killed on the spot. No, you buried bodies where you could, but there were lots of bodies you couldn't get at, you know, on that sort of countryside.
When you did the burials, were you able to have a proper service?
Well, I had a little, a very short private service.
Yes.
You know, a very personal one, really.
So it's prayers over the,
yes,
the graveside.
Yes. And you know, the bodies have got two identity discs, a red one and a green one. You left the green one on the body, around the neck, and you took the red one off, all the personal effects, which you sent back to relatives eventually.
Mm. Were you able to mark the graves?
You marked the grave with a little wooden cross, you know, a roughly made wooden cross, and a bottle or tin upside down with instructions about who the chap was and so on. And then you sent back your details to the war graves people who were following you up, telling him where the grave was, giving map reference and so on. I think all the graves that I marked were found. There was one they couldn't find. I had to go back later on, back to Kohima from a place down the road. A young man who was killed, I'll tell you about him later. After the Battle of Kohima, they'd done one of these, going to do one of their left hooks. I'd gone to see them the night before they set off. They were positioned, and they said, "Why don't you come with us?" Well, it was a Saturday, actually, and I said I would. I'd go with them, you see, on this trek round. To be with the company. I'd never done it before. But I thought, well, what a good idea. And this young man called Michael Morris was a great pal of mine. I'll tell you about him in a moment. He wasn't a soldier. He was a man of the theater. He was a stage manager to Norman Marshall, who was a West End producer and making a great name for himself. So he had a wonderful future. But Michael Morris had just got married